Hello and welcome to the Healthcare Podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Healthcare Podcast, where we bring you the topics, insights, thought leaders, and discussions that may just change the way you think about healthcare. In today's episode, we are going to talk about your people and your hospital. How you can decrease turnover, increase engagement, maximize your earning potential, and reduce your costs. The healthcare industry has become notoriously complex. As a patient, navigating the system of insurance, co-payments, referrals, specialists, hospitals, in-network, out-of-network, labs, and bills can all be overwhelming. The same is true as a clinician or a healthcare administrator. There are mountains of bureaucracy and administrative paperwork. There are pre-authorizations, EMRs, faxes, orders, patient histories, quality measures, reimbursement, education, continuing education, certifications, the list goes on. But if you ask anyone why they became a doctor or got into healthcare in the first place, the likely response would be to help people. Any business, any organization is about people, made up of people, run by people, serving people. That people service is especially obvious in healthcare, where everyone exists to serve a patient's health. But there is a people problem in healthcare. Healthcare has the second highest employee turnover rate of any industry. Nurse turnover was 17% in 2018. Physicians are burning out at an unprecedented rate. According to a national physician survey, 42% of physicians are burned out, meaning they have long-term, unresolvable job-related stress that leads to exhaustion, cynicism, feelings of detachment from job responsibilities, and lack a sense of personal accomplishment. What can you do about it? How can we reverse the trends for the health of our organizations, for the health of our people, and for the health of our patients? With those numbers and questions in mind, today we have a very special guest, just the person we needed, an expert in organizational transformation, Mr. Alistair Stewart. Alistair began his career optimizing business performance by focusing on employee engagement and growth through the spread of effective leadership, empowerment, and company culture. To accomplish these ends, he developed programs for improving morale, engagement, professional growth, and senior leadership development. After supporting the launch and scaling of multiple world-class indoor rock climbing facilities, Alistair moved into a focus on people operations. He has worked with a number of companies, helping to scale their success through organizational design and development, employee experience, employee engagement, coaching, facilitation, recruiting and hiring, and retention. Alistair is currently an organizational transformation consultant at The Ready, where he helps teams and organizations realize a more adaptive, meaningful, and human way of working. A lifelong learner and experimenter, Alistair has held leadership positions, developed teams, and cultivated organizational change along the way. Always curious and ready to listen, Alistair comes with an open mind and a toolbox of approaches, disciplines, and methodologies, because he believes that everyone in every organization is different. And that's the point. Alistair has coached people at every level of organizations, including CEOs, on the people side of strategic decisions, cultivating true leaders capable of fantastic organizational transformation in the process. Alistair is no stranger to facilitation, conflict resolution, coaching, and organizational change. Overall, Alistair is a force in enabling resilient and impactful organizations and continues to build environments that enable people to realize their full potential. Welcome to the show, Alistair, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We are super excited, very lucky to have you. I can't wait to dig into some of these topics. I usually like to start the show with a quote and found one that maybe captures some of what the heart and soul of what we are going to be talking about today, and that is people. We look at organizations as machines sometimes and can forget that people make up organizations. So the quote I found for today is from Andrew Carnegie, who said simply, "There is little success where there is little laughter." So I really like that quote. I just felt like it does. It kind of captures kind of what we're talking about. We think about success and these organizational machines, but forgetting about the people, and laughter is sort of a innate human response to things. And I don't know, just thought it was a nice place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that really hits the nail on the head in terms of, yeah, us liking to pretend that organizations are machines that, you know, can be carefully understood and sort of manipulated and operated in a certain way. And yeah, that's they are just people, and you can't separate the human from the human. So it's important that people are able to, I mean, people are going to be people when they come to work regardless, but pretending that's not the case can lead to a lot of issues.
Tell me a little bit more, like, what exactly is organizational transformation? It sounds like a pretty daunting undertaking.
Yeah, so in most cases, when you hear that phrase, it really means sort of a big, top-down, really complicated transformation, which generally just means sort of redrawing the org chart and imposing a lot of changes on, you know, on a big group of people. It generally means trying to design it perfectly up front, you know, spending a year deciding what the perfect, you know, what the perfect organization is going to look like. And then, you know, spending another year sort of rolling it out and imposing it on people and trying to get them to sort of quote unquote buy in. And usually it doesn't work. And then, you know, a couple years later, you do it all over again. In our case, we take a different approach. And so for us, organizational transformation is all about working with individuals and teams and groups within organizations to learn new ways of working, ways that are more adaptive, more resilient, more human, and also helping them build the capacity to continuously experiment and continuously improve their ways of working. And in doing that, and the more of that you have happening across an organization, the more capacity the organization as a whole has to continuously adapt and be resilient in the face of a, you know, not only an environment that's changing, but in fact, the rate of change is accelerating. So that's kind of how we think about organizational transformation.
That's very cool. It sounds like you described sort of two approaches to it. One of them, I heard you say the word impose like three times. And the other one sounds like a more sort of from within view. Is that where you see a big difference in success for these two types of approaches?
Yeah, that's definitely a big part of it. And, you know, part of it is that if you include people in, you know, deciding and determining what they need and what ways of working are going to best serve them in their context, you know, they are going to be more engaged and invested in making those changes. You know, so from a sort of, again, quote unquote, buy-in perspective, it's more effective on that front, but also, and more importantly, in fact, the people who are doing their jobs in their, you know, their places in the organization, interacting with customers or whoever it is they're serving, are actually the best people to figure out what they need and how to improve those things. So not only do you get more engagement and buy-in in the overall transformation process, but in fact, you actually transform the organization much more effectively into something that is more fit to its current context and opportunities and challenges.
Got it. Yeah, that sounds like a really great approach. I know that when I've been part of organizations, everyone gets a little bit, occasionally discouraged when, you know, someone tells you what you need versus you being able to tell them what you need to do your job better. But anyways, I digress as a personal anecdote relative to that. So, you know, what made you interested in people and organizational transformation in the first place?
Yeah, so coming out of college, my first full-time job was a leadership position. And we had a round of anonymous employee surveys. And I just got some very painful feedback about the way I was showing up and the impact I was having on people. At that time I was showing up in a pretty controlling way and just really focused on sort of process and details and these kinds of things. And, you know, people didn't feel supported. They didn't feel empowered. It wasn't, you know, I was certainly not helping them fulfill their potential. And that was a big inflection point for me. And I just sort of realized, like, this is not at all the impact I want to have. This is not at all, you know, how I want to show up for people. And that sort of started me on my path of learning more about leadership development and effective management and what, you know, company culture and how to develop an effective company culture. And that, you know, more and more I was interested in and felt that the biggest impact you could have in an organization was with the people, you know, that you can get some returns on improving a process or a tool or something like that. But if you can help people really fulfill their potential, then that's going to be the biggest opportunity to have an impact on the organization. And then over time, as I kind of got deeper and deeper into some of that learning and practice, I learned more about things like complexity theory and systems thinking, and, you know, just realized more and more that the systems that people show up inside of, and so that's systems, you know, not just sort of maybe software systems or systems like that, but also policies and procedures and norms and dynamics, all of these things that people show up inside of have an enormous impact on, you know, not only the way they feel and their behavior and decisions, but their performance, their growth, their satisfaction. It's not, you know, it is something you can tackle on an individual level, but really the way to make big change is to think at the systems level. And so in realizing that, I became more and more interested in organizational design and thinking, how can you help organizations shift those systems so that, you know, the organization itself is fostering the kind of experience and growth and performance that it needs.
I think that's very admirable that you started this whole career based on some negative feedback you got. And many people would say, oh, well, they don't know what they're talking about, or, oh, maybe I'll get better next year. But you really embarked on this transformative sort of, it sounds like personal transformation that led you to a career path where you were excited and passionate about organizational transformation, which is really cool.
Yeah, that's you know, I'm just grateful that I had the opportunity to get that experience. And it was certainly tempting, of course, to think like, well, they just don't. But, you know, yeah, it was hard to ignore. So I'm glad that I had the opportunity to get that kind of feedback and be able to make a decision from there as to what direction I wanted to go in.
Yeah, well, I didn't know that. For those listening, Alistair and I do go back a little ways. We are friends. I didn't know that story, so I appreciate you sharing it. And it's one of the reasons I was excited to have you, because I know you have that kind of perspective and self-awareness that is really beneficial when talking about, you know, things like, you know, physician burnout or nurse turnover or these healthcare organizations that I think are really struggling, especially right now with some pretty big people problems. So, you know, as we dive in a little bit more into what this all means for like a company, an organization, if someone's listening and they're, you know, running a hospital or a department or even self-managing, I mean, when you work with a company and you hear something, you know, you sit down with the CEO or whoever, and they're like, well, we have a turnover problem. And that's kind of all they say. They put the problem sort of almost, you know, it's on their organization, but it's almost external. Like, I don't know, we have some kind of amorphous turnover problem. What are your initial thoughts when you hear something like that?
Yeah, so my initial thoughts are just that I'd want to know more. You know, there are, when an organization has a turnover problem, there are certainly common things that can be contributing to that. And, you know, organizations are sort of complex systems and they have emergent outcomes, you know, things that you can't tie back to a single kind of cause or a single cause and effect chain. And so it's really important when working with an organization on something like that, you know, if you have the complexity that comes with a big organization and one of the outcomes is people are leaving, you know, it's important not to oversimplify it. And so my initial reaction would just be to try to understand more about what's going on inside that organization and for that organization that might be resulting in that trend of people leaving.
Yeah, well, I suppose that definitely makes sense. You need to dig a little deeper when someone just says something kind of a blanket statement like that. But I mean, are these the types of problems, you know, turnover problems, especially something that you see as more industry agnostic? Or is this sort of like, listen, everybody deals with this. We just have to get to, you know, why it's happening specifically in your company rather than an industry? I hear people in different industries, and certainly you know, various healthcare industries, for example, like long-term care facilities or home health care companies. And they say, you know, yeah, no, turnover is normal in this industry. We have people, and if they get a 12-cent raise, they go somewhere else. And it's normal for turnover to happen, and we just deal with it. You know, is that something that you see as being that, you know, you can claim it's just normal for us, or is it not necessarily the case?
So I definitely think that particular industries and particular types of organizations may have sort of patterns and dynamics that lend themselves to increased turnover. And so kind of my thought on how that happens is, if you have a particular industry, you know, again, thinking about complexity, there's a lot of forces and factors at play, you know, political forces, social forces, economic forces, all these kinds of things. And so you might end up with organizations that have similar ways of operating, similar internal dynamics, that run into similar problems, whether that's because that's sort of the path of least resistance within that environment, or that's because they see what, you know, they learn from each other and reinforce those ways of working. So it could certainly be that most organizations in a particular industry run into that problem. Now, that isn't to say that there's nothing you can do about it or that it's a foregone conclusion. You can say, yeah, we're making a strategic decision to just deal with that level of turnover because we don't want to invest more money or make any other changes to keep people. So instead, we're just willing to pay the price of turnover. Sure, you can make that strategic decision. You know, we can talk about whether that's likely to be a good decision, but that is different from saying, like, this is just how it is here. From a this is just how it is here perspective, you know, just because you've gotten where you've gotten by looking at your peers or by operating within a certain set of sort of industry or more broad dynamics, that doesn't mean you can't make changes, right? So even if these are trends that happen at a industry level or a global level, you know, each organization still has the opportunity to change the way they work and to do things differently in order to decrease turnover if they want to, right? But that's the key, is they have to, it has to be important enough to prioritize and invest in it. And often it isn't.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, that's a good point. It's almost like, you know, making the decision to invest in that particular area, I think, or it can be hard, definitely, running an organization when you look at the, you know, your costs, your investments, your, you know, and is the people investment or the organizational, you know, transformation investment to reduce my turnover? It's like, well, you know, there's plenty of X, Y, or Z. We could always just hire new people. It's not that big of a deal. And I think maybe people don't see or feel the long-term cost impacts of that in terms of new hire training, the time it takes to find someone to fill a position. You know, there's a lot of back-end costs associated with just like, oh, we'll just, they'll leave, we'll get somebody new in there. Is that something, you know, say you're talking to a new client and they're on the fence, like, I don't know if we want to make this type of investment. Are those hard costs types of things that come up very often in conversation that you either point to or that maybe folks are missing when they think about their turnover problem as just a given?
Yeah. So, you know, it's really natural for us humans to want to really, you know, we tend to think, we kind of look one or two steps back, you know, and what we think are causing things and then what we think the outcomes will be. And we do tend to focus on, you know, show me the numbers, and the more you get out into second, third, fifth, 10th order impacts, the harder it is for people to sort of understand and accept that's how those trickle effects or those ripple effects are happening. And so it is important to help people think through, you know, not only is there the sort of more upfront cost of, you know, yeah, having to hire and retrain people, which is extremely expensive. But there's also opportunity costs associated with losing the, you know, the sort of capital knowledge and understanding of the organization and the particular customers and environment that you have when you have an existing employee, you know, as well as the relationships they've built. And, you know, if you have people who are part of a high performing team and then they leave, that's going to disrupt that team. It's very, very difficult to fully, it's impossible to like quantitatively understand the financial impact of turnover. And it's even difficult to think about it quantitatively, but I would say generally the impact and cost is, you know, significantly higher than most people think it is. And that's just talking about, you know, the financial impact. I mean, there are other sort of currencies at play here. You know, what impact does it have on the experience and performance of your employees who are staying when there's so much turnover, when so many other people are choosing to leave, when the people they're close to or work with are disappearing? You know, what impact does that have on them? And what impact does that have on the service you provide? And, you know, there are a lot of impacts that come with that. And so thinking of, it's very easy, I think, especially in very large organizations where you have, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people, to take a sort of transactional view of that. You know, we have a person, we pay the money, they do the thing. If they leave, we get a new person, we pay them the same money, they do the same thing. Doesn't seem like it makes much difference, right? And it's just, that just isn't how it works in reality. So it's certainly a really impactful, it's a very impactful factor. And it's also, it's easy to underestimate the impact it's having.
That's a really good point. I didn't really, even in thinking about it, you know, preparing for the show or just in general, when I think about it for, you know, my organization or others, that impact from a morale perspective, a productivity, yeah, it's easy to say, you know, here are the dollars and cents, but, you know, we're just talking all about how, or, you know, people make up organizations. And if those people are nervous or unhappy or, you know, otherwise disenfranchised in some way because they're seeing all this turnover, I mean, that can have a really big impact that is, like you said, not as quantifiable. Mm-hmm. So let's jump into some healthcare specifically. So I mentioned just in the intro that there's a really big turnover problem with nurses in the hospital. What's your hot take on that?
My guess is that there's a lot of factors at play here. So, you know, if you think about in Dan Pink's book Drive, he talks about autonomy, mastery, and purpose as sort of what are the key factors in human intrinsic motivation and satisfaction and those kinds of things. And so as I think about my understanding of a nurse's experience, you know, I can see why it would be such a hard environment to work in. So, you know, first of all, there very well might be a misalignment between their purpose and the purpose of the hospital. So, you know, if you joined, you know, your profession or became a nurse and went through that process to help people, but you are heavily constrained by a system that's actually focused on making money, that is an enormous misalignment in purpose. And that's going to be extremely frustrating and demoralizing. You know, if you are someone who wants to solve hard problems and you want to make an impact, but you are just surrounded and admired by massive bureaucracy that just really stops you from even properly leveraging your hard-earned expertise and experience, not to mention what it's stopping you from doing is, you know, more meaningfully helping people, that's going to be really frustrating and demoralizing. And if you are skilled and knowledgeable and you're experienced, but you aren't always trusted to make decisions, and you find that you sort of are taking orders from, you know, maybe a doctor or maybe an administrator instead of being trusted to use your professional discretion to help care for people, that's also going to be really, really frustrating and demoralizing and exhausting. And so then if you, you know, take all of that, that stuff would all be really frustrating in any position. But if you take into that the fact that, you know, there are all these other factors that make the job so stressful and emotionally taxing in terms of the work you're doing, the hours you're working, these kinds of things, you know, it seems to me that it's not hugely surprising that nurses are kind of burning out and, you know, they're leaving their positions.
Yeah, well, that's a lot. I mean, yeah, that does paint a sort of, if all those factors were the case in any one person's sort of working environment, that paints a pretty unpleasant picture. I am a huge fan, by the way, of Dan Pink's work in Mastery, Autonomy, and Purpose. I watch that TED Talk, like, I don't know, once a quarter or something, just to really ingrain it. Everybody, you know, especially sometimes you work with people and they're like, oh, money's my number one thing. And I'm like, is it really? Like, anyways. I digress. I completely agree with you. So talk to me though a little bit about, it's kind of, my first reaction is, okay, those are all really good examples. And I think they're all ring pretty true. I think a lot of people probably have those experiences and you almost want to go, okay, well, we'll just fix it. Let's just do the opposite. Let's just, you know, you're feeling like you have to take orders. Let's like make it so that you don't have to take orders all the time, or you're feeling like, you know, you're not really serving your purpose. Like, well, like, let's just, you know, make it so you're serving your purpose. You know, it seems like let's just do the opposite of what's happening right now and we'll fix it. But I have the sense that it's probably a little bit more nuanced and complicated than that. And important because, you know, this turnover problem you know, not only affects patient treatment, but like we kind of talked about, I mean, it affects the bottom line. The hospital, you know, constantly training and retraining and recruiting and spending lots of resources hiring new people. So, you know, what in your estimate and expertise could be done about that type of turnover issue with nurses?
Yeah. So, you know, what I think is funny is that actually, I think you're onto something by saying doing the opposite of those things. I do think that if we could, you know, wave a magic wand and say, okay, now you are able to, you are sort of empowered to make decisions that enable you to use your mastery and are aligned with your purpose. You know, I do think that would actually make a huge difference in the experience that nurses are having and, you know, the quality of care and the overall operations of the hospital, for example. But you're right, you know, it's actually figuring out how to achieve those things that is extremely challenging. And so maybe it is as simple as doing the opposite of that, but actually doing the opposite of that is not so simple. And so, you know, a lot of this though does come down to really listening to the people that we're talking about here. You know, how can you really listen to the people who are leaving, listen to the people who are staying, like understand what's getting in their way, and what's undermining their experience. And then how can you actually not just take what you've heard and make changes, but how can you create an environment where they get to make the changes, like where they can shape how they work? You know, I think if you can take a group of people and you can allow them to, you know, sort of apply their mastery and have the autonomy they need to meaningfully pursue their purpose, that's going to totally transform their experience. How many people actually say that's their experience at work? I think if you can create that experience for someone, they're very unlikely to go somewhere else. And you know, there's evidence to show that the results, the outcomes you'll get, the organizational performance will be remarkable, both in terms of things like that you might expect in terms of like quality of care and things like that, but even from an efficiency perspective. So there's this Dutch home care organization called Birdsorg, which is a remarkable sort of case study specifically for what this looks like in healthcare. And I would definitely recommend you and anyone listening to dive deeper into it, because it's pretty mind blowing, but I have sort of some things here to share about it. So this is a home care organization consisting of self-managing teams of nurses. So these teams of nurses, like 10 to 15 nurses, are fully responsible for the end-to-end home care within their neighborhood. So each team of nurses has essentially sort of a territory they're responsible for. And they are just essentially like, they're autonomous and self-managed, and they do whatever they need to do to pursue their purpose, which is helping their patients become healthy and autonomous. So that's the purpose. And they are basically set, you know, they have self-managing teams that pursue this purpose for their area. And, you know, it's a remarkable organization. So they have really minimum centralized support. So I think it's like, you know, based on what I read, they have 30 people in support functions to support 7,000 nurses. So if you think about, you know, the admin overhead in most organizations and how much that kind of starts to bloat, you know, they just have 30 people doing that. And that's because the vast majority of everything these nurses are doing, you know, from care decisions to how they're building relationships in the community to where their office is to, you know, recruiting and hiring, they do all of that themselves, and they do it as a self-managed team in pursuit of their purpose. They don't have any managers. They have coaches. The organization has coaches that teams can request. So if a team is sort of struggling with their interpersonal dynamics or they just feel like they can't get themselves unstuck, they can request a coach to come in who has no formal authority, but is just there to help them, you know, sort of help coach them through their challenges. And they've seen like truly remarkable results. So there's a book I would recommend to anyone who's interested in this kind of thing called Reinventing Organizations. It's by Frederick Laloux. It's all about some of this new evolutionary step in organizations. And so these are some sort of statistics from his case study. I mean, this is from 2014. So this is, you know, six years ago money. But based on them, you know, they were a conventional organization and they transitioned into this new structure and way of working. They saw a 40% reduction in hours of care that patients needed. Patients stayed in care for half as long. They saw remarkable savings. So if Ernst & Young did some modeling, and if, you know, at the time, U.S. home care sort of as a whole transitioned to this other way of working and saw similar savings, it would be something like $49 billion in savings. Mm-hmm. And keeping in mind that's with a dramatic increase in the quality of care that people are getting. And they saw a 60% reduction in absenteeism with their nurses and a 33% reduction in turnover from transitioning to this self-managing way of working. So that's just an example of how, you know, you really can sort of have your cake and eat it too if you are able and willing and have the courage as an organization to make some dramatic changes where, you know, your employee experience is significantly better, your, you know, customer or patient experience and outcomes are significantly better, and your financial outcomes are significantly better.
That is amazing. I mean, I've never heard of this before, but that is fantastic. Did you say Birdsorg? and is the organization in the Netherlands. And then the book, which includes that case study, is by a Frederick Laloux.
Yep, that's right.
All right, I will definitely put a link to those two items because that is fascinating. And I mean, it does sound like we talk in healthcare all the time. You know, we have like triple aims and we have all these different things and, you know, more access, less cost, better outcomes. And everyone always says like, it's not possible. Like, you can't have your cake and eat it too. But we do see, and I understand, and people are going to say easily like, well, that's the Netherlands. This is the United States. It doesn't work the same way here. And sure, maybe it's not exactly the same, but I do think that there are a lot of instances, and like you said, it does take courage, but that we could see some pretty radical and transformative change happen by, you know, trying some things out like this and using someone like you, your expertise, and maximizing you know, the output of individuals. And it could be like, you know, as simple, quote unquote, as, you know, flipping what they're doing now and focusing on that, you know, purpose, mastery, and autonomy a little bit more. But so you mentioned something, self-managing teams. So that sounds, well, I mean, it sounds borderline revolutionary. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that? I mean, like, what is a self-managing team? How would you even just, what do you say? Like, all right, guys, you know what? You're on your own. You got it. Have fun. Or, I mean, like, help me understand, one, what they are, and two, how do you even implement something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. So a self-managing team is basically what it sounds like. And it is pretty, I mean, it's certainly a whole different set of sort of principles and approach than the conventional command and control approach to management and leadership. So a self-managing team is essentially a team that does for itself what the manager would normally do top down. So things like setting their priorities, developing their internal processes, monitoring and developing their own performance, and just generally making decisions about how to work and what to work on. And they're generally most effective when they're cross-functional. So, you know, the one of the most effective versions of this is when you can have a self-managing team, just like the nurses at Birdsog, who are end-to-end, right? So they have what they need from the very beginning of sort of the customer journey all the way through delivering whatever value the customer needs. Like they have all the capabilities they need. You know, so in software development, you have cross-functional teams that have, you know, product owners and software developers and testers and anything else you need, you know, to go from here's what the customer needs to here, let's ship some software to them that does what they need it to do. So self-managing teams are, yeah, teams who are capable of doing all of those things themselves. And, you know, so there's a couple of advantages to that. One is that they're just way more capable of sensing and responding to the environment they're in to create as much value as possible for their customers. So instead of having, you know, the center of the organization taking in all the information, you know, very slowly and in a filtered way, and then making decisions and then rolling those decisions out. And by the time they do that, you know, the information they're using is out of date. You can have teams on the edge of the organization that are continuously interacting with the organization's environment and with the customers and with other dynamics, sensing risks, sensing opportunities, and making decisions to adapt to those changing circumstances, which is a complete game changer in how effective an organization can be overall, especially as the world gets, you know, even more complex and ambiguous and is changing even more quickly. And you also have the benefit of, you know, it enables that autonomy, purpose, and mastery for the members of the team, because they are part of this unit that is able to make decisions for itself and is able to grow and learn and is able to pursue their purpose sort of in many ways unencumbered. You know, and instead of having a quote unquote leader or someone in a position of formal authority, different members of the team are able to sort of step forward and step back from moments of leadership as needed, you know, as circumstances change. So that's what a self-managing team is. And yeah, in terms of implementing it, you know, it can get a little bit more complicated. You definitely, you know, it would be tough to say, okay, you know, you're on your own, figure it out. You know, I think there's an element of helping teams learn what their options are in terms of how to operate effectively as a self-managed team. So at the Ready, when we help teams or organizations transition into having self-managing teams, you know, a big part of that is helping these teams just learn about what self-management is, what the principles are that underlie it, what the benefits are, and then helping them learn new principles and practices that can help you be an effective self-managed team. So ways of communicating, ways of, you know, having like meeting structures to use, you know, different cadences of reflection and learning and continuous improvement in their ways of working. And so, you know, we help teach teams those things, and then the teams, you know, are able to adopt what they want to adopt and start where they want to start, and over time use those practices to improve. And, you know, we provide coaching to help them do that, but they're the ones that are making those decisions about how they're going to work, you know, what they're going to work on and these kinds of things. One of the, you know, two big challenges that you can find in terms of moving more towards a self-managed model is, one is just, you know, the conventional power structure wants to hold on to that control, right? So when you have managers and managers and managers, you know, at every level, there are people who, you know, understandably kind of want to hold on to their control. And they also, you know, there's a serious lack of trust for people and employees within organizations. And there's fear that if you let people make decisions for themselves, you know, everything's going to go off the rails. And so changing those mindsets can be really hard, and also helping people in management and leadership positions reframe their role. You know, so there's a very real role for leaders in organizations that are more self-managed in terms of creating conditions and holding space for these things to happen. But that is a different role than a manager or a leader who is making decisions and giving direction and dictating and you know, sort of being the captain from that perspective. So that's one challenge. And then another challenge is just dependencies. So it's very difficult when you have a subset of an organization transitioning into self-management, and you have, you know, you help stand up these teams that you know, have everything they need. They're excited. They want to be purpose-driven. But if they have external dependencies within the organization, and either things are being imposed on them externally, or, you know, they're blocked because they aren't fully end-to-end. They aren't fully autonomous. That can be a real challenge too, because they have this new capability to move fast and learn and take, you know, make decisions, get things out into the wild and learn from it. And then they get slowed down by these external conditions. So that's another challenge that you can run into.
It sounds pretty exciting, or potentially exciting, to have kind of those teams like that. And I really like the sort of speed aspect and the connection. Definitely worked in organizations where, you know, you're supposed to talk to the people who are talking to the people who you want to hear from, and then letting someone else know what the people who were talking to the people, you know, about the people said. And it's like a giant game of telephone, and then you have to aggregate it all, as opposed to having, you know, and then you push something out, as opposed to having just that, like you said, the sort of quick reaction at people of the edges of the organization, which I really like that phrase. That's really great. Is there a, I guess it would be maybe contradictory to the whole structure of it, but is there a manager of a self-managing team, or a leader? Or you mentioned that it was sort of as needed, people kind of move into leadership role. But I think maybe the good example is you're in college or graduate school or high school or whatever, and they're like, all right, everybody pick your team. And then you're like, now do this assignment. And like, naturally somebody kind of bubbles up as the person who's leading. But in these self-managed teams, is there like a formal kind of leader, or it just depends on the team as if they need one or not? And how does that kind of work? Or am I stuck in a traditional way of thinking?
I think it's a really important question. So there is not a manager. You know, if you have a self-managed team, that team wouldn't have a manager. Now, there's certainly a role for leadership within the team and outside of the team. So within the team, depending on the team might decide, you know, again, they're as with anything, right? There are degrees of these things. So there are teams that are more self-managed and more autonomous. Doesn't make them fully self-managed and fully autonomous. But there can certainly be a lead role in a team that has certain responsibilities in terms of interacting with the broader system, or in terms of, you know, being able to develop relationships with other teams. There are other things that you might have a sort of lead role do. You don't necessarily need to have that, but you might choose to. You know, that lead role is going to have responsibilities that we might associate with a leader, but what they're not going to have generally is sort of a lot of formal power to impose changes on the team. So even in those circumstances, the team would still need to have the ability to decide for itself. It no longer needs to have a lead role, or someone else needs to be in that lead role, or whatever that looks like. So it would be important that the team is able to decide and design those things on an ongoing basis. But you might still have someone in a role that sort of is a lead position. And you're going to have moments within the team, you know, all of this, of course, depends on how you define leadership. But in terms of, you know, either helping set direction or helping create conditions or helping connect people to their purpose or whatever, there might be different moments, you know, or navigating a crisis, whatever it is, might be different moments, you know, even within a day where different members of the team are going to step into being more of a leader and then step back from that. And someone else will step into being a leader depending on what's needed, right? So that the capacity to lead is not limited to one particular role based on its formal authority. So that's the leadership piece for within the team. Then there is definitely a role to play, unless you have an organization that is entirely self-managed, which is, you know, super rare. Generally, these things happen more. You'll have someone in a leadership position who's sort of inspired and excited by these things and energized and feels like this is really important. And what they need to do is they need to use their formal authority and probably their, you know, their influence and their, you know, social and political capital and these kinds of things to create the space within the organization for self-management to happen. And so when you're trying to have self-management inside of an organization that as a whole is not self-managed, is more of a command and control, top-down, you know, higher sort of formal authority hierarchy, that will, you know, self-management will get stifled and sort of like, you know, stomped out immediately, unless you have someone who actually has positional authority to create the space for that stuff to happen and to stop other organizational factors from, you know, basically getting in there and messing it up, you know, for lack of a better term. Because if you have self-management, as soon as someone externally is imposing their will on, you know, that team, that's sort of, in a lot of ways, it's kind of game over. It's like, you're not autonomous then, right? If there's always the chance or the likelihood that someone's going to step in and make that decision for you, you're not really making that decision. And so there's certainly a role for those with positional authority within an organization. And this could even be the CEO, right? Or the board creating space if it's a publicly held company, you know, so it might be the CEO creating space and making sure the board doesn't do anything that's going to stifle these ways of working. Or it could be the CEO and the board creating space and managing that with shareholders if it's a publicly owned company, right? But, you know, there's always a level at which there needs to be someone with that sort of recognized authority who is creating the conditions to allow all of this other stuff to happen. And so that's an extremely important role for leaders as well.
Got it. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One other aspect I was just sort of curious about from a practical standpoint. So I'm a big fan of, in general, sort of like a test and learn approach, doing things on a small scale and then rolling them out. I think kind of, as you mentioned, when we very first started about like organizational change, and then it's this big imposition and you try to make it perfect just by talking about it, and then you kind of roll it out all at once. But instead of doing that, and I think about it in maybe a hospital or something too, you know, you have so many different departments and areas. You know, you have the emergency department, you have the OB department, you have general surgery and vascular surgery and all these different areas. I mean, is it typical if you're working for an organization and just sort of thinking from like if a CEO of a hospital does that, you know what, this is really fascinating. I want to try this out. I like the home care study, although it's obviously different, but let's try it out in a hospital. Could they kind of pick one group or one team to try it out with first, give them the sort of resources and sort of see how it goes? And if they did that, would there be certain measures that they should be looking for to say, yes, this is working, or no, this is just a dramatic failure. I don't know what this crazy podcast is about, and I'm never trying this again.
So absolutely. I think that approach of, yeah, testing and learning, you know, that experimental approach is really, really important, because you can't know before you try how different things are going to work in different contexts. So yeah, absolutely. I think you could certainly do that. It's just important to, as with any experiment, you know, you have to figure out what you're trying to learn, what your hypothesis is, and, you know, what it might lead to. And so that's one thing to think about in terms of, okay, if this works, is this telling us, are we learning things that we can apply more broadly, you know, or are we creating conditions here that would be, that we would be unwilling to create in other places? But I think also it's important to create those conditions that are needed for to get the benefits. And so, for example, making sure that a team is cross-functional or does have what it needs in order to be, you know, to really make the most of being autonomous and self-managing, right? So you wouldn't want to have a team inside of a functional silo necessarily that is, you know, where the team members are being pulled in by other teams or they're sort of taking orders and providing services. Having them or pretending that they're self-managed and you know, autonomous is just going to lead to frustration because they won't be, right? There are other factors that are constraining their decisions. But if you could find a team of, you know, of healthcare professionals who, as much as possible, could sort of provide end-to-end care for their particular set of patients, yeah, I think you could absolutely try that and see what you learned. And you just have to be really mindful of what are all of the different, you know, factors or conditions that might get in the way. And, you know, we sometimes talk about sort of organizational antibodies, right? There's a status quo, there's equilibrium, and you try something new, and it's amazing what different forces come out of the woodwork to just stifle that and force it back into the status quo. And so thinking about, you know, again, the position, if there's someone with the authority to create the space for that to happen and to be courageous in the face of other people being like, what are you doing? This is a waste of time. This is a waste of money. This is too risky, you know, and really to be able to stand that ground and say, this is important. We need to give it a chance to see how it works and hold that space is really, really important. And then in terms of what you look at to see if it's working, I think it depends on what you're hoping for and what your hypothesis is. So if you think that if you want to try to have a self-managing team because you want it to improve employee experience, well, you know, then you'd want to make sure that you're measuring employee experience, make sure you're getting feedback and understanding, you know, what this experience is like and the impact of it on the people involved. You know, if you want to improve customer experience or patient care, you'd want to make sure you had a way of measuring that over time. You know, if it's financial, it's the financial side, you'd want to make sure you could measure that over time. So it would really just be a matter of what you're hoping to gain from introducing self-management in terms of what you'd want to measure. And then, you know, just recognizing that it's going to take a little bit of time for something like that, you know, for a team to learn how to operate in that way and to really gel and to start to see the impact. You know, you'd have to be willing to let it, you know, you may or may not, but you very well may see sort of a dip initially, right, in performance or outcomes, because this group of people has to unlearn and relearn how they're going to work together. So you have to have the sort of the courage and the patience to be able to protect that space as the leader as that happens. And you know, then once you start to see the upswing, you know, to continue to hold that space and see where it goes.
Great. No, that's I hope some people try it. I definitely wanna implement some self-managing teams, you know, where I am. It sounds a little scary, but it sounds like it could have some really substantial payoff. I think if we take a moment and say, what environment would I like most to work in? It sounds a lot like that type of environment where mm-hmm. you have that that runway to you know, do what you think is best with some, you know, perhaps some leadership direction, but, you know, align with the purpose of the organization, but to really be able to spread your wings, as it were. So I want to shift a little bit. We sort of been talking almost in the context of like nurses, but like broadly in healthcare organizations. And as I mentioned earlier, physician burnout is a huge issue. It's a huge topic. Where, you know, in the United States in 2020, there's a projected, or in 2025 rather, there's a projected physician shortage that's going to start rearing its ugly head, you know, for a lot of different reasons, you know, not least of which is burnout. You know, when 42% of physicians are like, you know, I'm basically not getting any satisfaction in my work and I'm over it, more or less. It's really hard for a lot of different reasons. It's a big issue that I'd love your insight on. So, you know, thinking with nearly half of all doctors being burned out, if you were the leader of an organization, say, you know, regional hospital, health system, whatever, and you had, you know, a couple thousand doctors, a few thousand doctors working for you, and your physicians are burning out, I mean, what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously an extremely tough position to be in. I think that I would talk to the physicians. You know, I would as much and as quickly as I could, I would involve them in the conversation and in the effort to figure out how to improve the situation so that they're not in that position anymore. You know, and so that looks like learning from them what is creating that burnout and what is what the factors are in that experience, and being willing to make changes based on that, but also, you know, creating the conditions where they can, again, they can have play a strong role in the shaping of the conditions they work within, and you know, the dynamics, organizational dynamics they're working within, and how they do their jobs, and all of these kinds of things, you know, and really, really involving them in being able to shape that stuff sort of continuously. And so, yeah, that's going to take, you know, that's going to take a lot of unlearning, and it's going to take a lot of bureaucracy busting and a lot of other things. But I think the only way you're really going to make a meaningful difference in that is to involve the people impacted in a meaningful way so that they can shape their experience into what it needs to be. And also, you know, again, in a way that enables them to pursue the purpose they're there to pursue.
That's a really great perspective on it. Bureaucracy busting. I like that. That's a book title for sure. So with burnout in mind, if we look into the data, just to dig into the topic a little bit more, the top three, maybe four reasons listed for burnout are, speaking of which, too many bureaucratic tasks, i.e. paperwork, charting, etc. Number one. Number two, spending too many hours at work, which definitely ties into the first point. Number three, lack of respect, from administrators and employers. Really, you know, maybe a power shift from how medicine was normally administered and practiced. And then number four, I'll include, which again really ties back to the first reason, is the electronic health records, electronic medical records, which is just a lot of now electronic paperwork. So with those three, four reasons in mind, the question is, you know, seeing this list, it seems like one of the big issues is there's too much work to be done outside of just caring for a patient. And, you know, let's just say that this is the world we live in. It's never going to change. I mean, what would you say, again, kind of putting on there, like, I'm the leader of a health organization, hat, you know, saying to these doctors who are burning out as a result of that? I mean, is it sort of almost like, you know, so you've talked to them, they've basically just echoed these reasons, but you have to, we're kind of in this system. We have to do the work. Is this just like, we just have to suck it up? You know, there's nothing we can do about it. You know, I don't really know how to help you because we have to fill out paperwork. We have to chart. We have to do EHRs. I mean, you know, I'm not sure there should be as much bureaucracy for doctors as there is and has they have to contend with, but maybe that's a different discussion. But I mean, again, knowing that, like, you know, it sort of is what it is. You have to do all this administrative paperwork. You have to deal with the electronic health records. I mean, what do you say or where do you go in that kind of a situation?
I think it depends on how much, you know, sort of positional authority I have to make some changes, or to create some space for changes to happen. Because in a lot, you know, I think especially in an industry that's obviously, you know, there are huge compliance needs and, you know, legal compliance and other compliance and privacy and all these other things that are super important and can lead to a lot of this bureaucracy. And in organizations like that are very focused on, you know, risk management and tracking things and legal compliance and these other things, you know, this bureaucracy can really accumulate over time. And a lot of it you actually don't need, even with those constraints. So I think what I would want to do in that position is I would want to work with doctors, nurses, administrators, whoever I could work with who understands the system that we're working in, and identify, okay, let's take a blank piece of paper. What are the actual constraints? Like, what do we actually have to do? And what is just a bunch of stuff we've built on top of that over time based on mistakes that have been made or based on concern about being able to trust people or based on that one lawsuit from 10 years ago or whatever, you know, what do we actually have to make sure happens, and what is stuff that we could actually change, and involving as many people, or at least as broad a cross section of different roles and people and functions as possible in that conversation, and do something that the Ready calls start by stopping. So we have all of this stuff, all of this, these rules, these procedures, these policies, all this bureaucracy, you know, in a lot of organizations, it's meetings, maybe not in a healthcare organization, but all of this stuff. What of it can we just stop doing? And maybe it's an experiment. Maybe we only stop doing it for 2 weeks or a month or a quarter, and just see what happens. Like, how much of this crap do we actually not need? And can we actually just get rid of? And not, we don't even have to change anything else. We can just open up this space so that, you know, they're not having to do so many tasks, so they're not spending as much time on this bureaucracy as opposed to helping people, you know, so that there aren't these adversarial relationships between a role that has to get, you know, this particular box checked with this particular signature from a doctor, you know, and they can't, the doctor won't do it, and the doctor is always being chased by, I'm making stuff up, I have no idea if this is how it works, but, you know, creating these situations where different groups of people are incentivized to do different things in different ways, and they're at odds with each other. How much of that stuff can we just stop doing to see what happens? And so just being really on, yeah, there are very real constraints and there are very real requirements, but there are probably not as many as we think they are. So that would be my thought from someone in a potentially in a leadership position. And then just more generally, and for anyone in a system, you know, there is only so much you as an individual inside of a system can do, to make changes when that system's getting in your way. But there is usually something you can do, right? And it's really, really easy. I think all of us have been in positions in organizations or in other systems where we end up with sort of, you know, with some learned helplessness because we've been shut down one too many times, or we've seen someone else get shut down one too many times. And we sort of go, there's nothing I can do about this. You know, I'm powerless. This is just the way it is. And usually there is usually something that you can do, even if it's a small step. Like if you take the approach of thinking each day, what's something small that I can do differently? Like, what's something small that I have the authority and the resources to do right now without having to ask anyone's permission that I think will even get me 5% or 10% towards a better working environment or better outcomes? Where is that thing? I'm going to try it. And then I'm going to try it again tomorrow. And I'm going to try it, you know, and if it works, I'll do it more of it. If it doesn't work, I'll try another thing. And it's hard to do that when you're busy and you're exhausted. But that opportunity generally is there. It's just a matter of, you know, honestly thinking small and being okay with, you know, what might be incremental improvement. But also, one of the interesting things about complex systems is sometimes a really small change can lead to really massive impact. So I think those would be the two pieces from my perspective.
Got it. Yeah, that's a really good, approach. I think those are really challenging issues. Like you said, you know, certainly it's a complex regulatory environment and reporting and, you know, all the different meaningful use and all these different things that have to be dealt with, but maybe there's a lot kind of layered on top of it, or, you know, peripherally or tertiarily or, you know, some other thing that maybe could be eliminated, reduced, or otherwise transformed. And all changes can really lead to, especially in complex systems, like you mentioned, really massive impacts, which I think is a good way to think about it. So let's say for a second, you know, I really like to play in some of the theoretical areas as much as I love to get into the tactical, because I always want people to listen to an episode and say, you know what, I can try that tomorrow, or it's Saturday right now. So in this case, the day after tomorrow, but nevertheless, but let's just say that you fixed it. You know, Alistair Stewart came in, fixed the turnover, fixed the burnout, you know, maximize your output and efficiency, you know, you revolutionize this healthcare, you know, a healthcare system, a hospital system. how do you operationalize something like that? Unless, you know, we don't have to be as grandiose as like you fixed everything, but even we took one team and, you know, transformed them, they're performing really well. But we always see this kind of happen, especially in the case where like a consultant comes in and we see some change for a little while, things go well, but we always drift back, you know, sort of like drift back to the mean, or what was really great for a year sort of eventually gets kind of eaten back up in the layers of complexity or bureaucracy or power structures or things like that. I mean, you know, what advice, how do you create that lasting change? What advice do you have for instituting long-term impactful changes once you've figured out what the recipe is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, my answer is sort of a little bit meta. As we kind of talked about at the beginning, there's one version of organizational transformation or organizational design where, you know, you say, okay, here's where we're at. And then we're going to spend 6 months and we're going to perfectly design the perfect organization that has all of the right, you know, hierarchy and the right processes and all of this stuff. And it's going to work great. Right. And the fact of the matter is that the world is constantly changing. You know, organizations are constantly changing. They're not a static, persistent thing, right? They're constantly shifting. And the environment they're in is constantly shifting. And so because of that, there isn't any one static organizational design that's just going to keep working. And so for that reason, that one of the keys really is to bake in the capacity for continuous transformation. So instead of implementing a new design that we think will work better, how can we teach teams and how can we develop within the organization the capacity to continuously transform based on the environment, right? Based on risks, based on opportunities. How can you have at all levels, sort of inside out, outside in, up, down, side to side, you know, people and teams sensing and responding within their context so that the organization is continuously changing in a way that allows it to be effective and adaptive and resilient and continue to pursue its purpose. And so that's a really, really key piece, is focusing on building the capacity for that continuous self-transformation versus a, you know, A to B, we were this thing, now we're going to transform into this thing, and then, you know, that'll work for a while, and then we'll do it again in 5 years or whatever. So that's a really important part of it. And at the Ready, we talk about an organization's operating system. You know, obviously that's a metaphor, but we use that to talk about the collection of implicit and explicit constraints that shape how the organization operates. So this is things like, you know, this is dimensions like authority, strategy, information, communication, purpose, resources, these different dimensions of an organization that meaningfully shape how it operates. And so those are the things that, you know, if you can build within an organization the capacity to continuously shape and transform across those things as needed, then that organization is going to be, you know, it's going to be so much more adaptive and resilient than, you know, most others as circumstances change, that it's going to be, it's just going to have a huge competitive advantage, you know, not to mention all of the more sort of human advantages of working in that way. And then the other thing, you know, truth be told, brings us back to this role of the leader in a transformation. When you don't have an organization that is, you know, fully self-managed and is legally owned by, you know, itself and all of these other things that can protect space for self-management to happen, you do need someone in a leadership position who has the formal authority to create and hold the space for those new ways of working to persist, even couched within larger systems that are more conventional and command and control oriented. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that often if there's a leader like that, you know, once if they leave, or if someone else, if they're replaced by someone who has a different mindset, you know, you'll often see a lot of backsliding back into old ways of working. And, you know, in some cases there, you know, and again, going back to Frederick Laloux's book, Reinventing Organizations, and other work in that vein, in some cases there have been organizations that have found huge success through becoming more self-managing and more adaptive. And usually there's a person, you know, with a position of authority who's creating the space for that. And, you know, in some cases that person has left, you know, and then the organization will start to backslide, and like they'll come back in, or the board will bring them back in, because all of a sudden someone else came in with different ideas, and, you know, the organization begins to go back to a more conventional way of operating and losing all of those advantages. You know, and in other cases, if that person leaves or that person is replaced or whatever, and the organization, yeah, will backslide back into more conventional ways of working, and will lose all of the advantages of working that way. So, you know, you do have to you do have to pretty continuously create and protect the space for those ways of working to flourish in the face of external forces, or, you know, the sort of weight of an inertia of the status quo can certainly stifle those things.
I mean, you know it better than anybody. That's the perfect answer to that question. You know, I think I'm learning a lot over the course of this conversation, and even my question, I think, was asked almost on a foundation of that traditional way of thinking. Like, okay, we've changed. Now let's hold the line at the change. When organizational transformation, as you said, is sort of about the continuous improvement, constantly changing, and being allowed and having the space, which I really like that imagery of having that space, but having the space to be allowed to change and adapt and transform, you know, said it a lot, but to transform over time, not just, okay, we got from A to B, let's hold the line at B and we're done, you know? So that's a really great way to think about it. And that was great. So thank you for that answer. I really liked it. If I could give you a megaphone, you know, right now, speak to every healthcare leader, administrator, you know, person in leadership position in the country right now, given all the issues that they're facing, there's burnout, there's turnover, people are nervous, people are scared, there's an economic issue, we're obviously still in the midst of a pandemic. What would you say to that group of people?
I think it would be something along the lines of give your people the opportunity and authority to create and shape their ways of working and to solve real problems in pursuit of their purpose. And, you know, if you provide the resources, information, you know, autonomy and trust that your people need to do their best work, they will, you know, and it'll pay off. So I think I would invite them to start there.
Oh, that's great. I love it. You know, that's a nice, short, succinct, but a lot of power behind kind of that statement to people, and you can go a lot of different places with it. So that's great. No, I appreciate it. Well, this has been a truly fascinating and I think very, very, very valuable conversation. So a quick thank you on that. But before we conclude, I always like to ask my guests a couple of rapid fire questions at the end that I have given you no notice of in the first place. And they're not that crazy, but if you'll indulge me, I'd love to hear from you and know what are your 1 to 3, it could be 1, it could be 3, all-time favorite books.
Oh, that's a tough one. Okay. I'm going to request that I frame it as sort of some of the most impactful books.
You may. This is a freeform question.
So one of them is definitely Reinventing Organizations, which I mentioned earlier. Completely changed, you know, the way that I thought about organizations and how they can operate. One is a book called The Fifth Discipline by Peter Senge. And it's sort of all about applying systems thinking to organizations and business management, which, again, totally changed the way that I thought about how those things could work and really opened my mind to a lot of things. And then let me see if I can think of a third. There's a book called The Coaching Habit, which is by Michael Bungay Stanier. And it is an extremely actionable and useful guide to being more coach-like as a manager and approaching the job of a manager more as a coach. And I found that book to be impactful. And I've also, it's a book that I've recommended to a lot of people and I've used in working with a lot of leaders and managers. And it's been, I've seen it be really impactful for how people show up. So I also, that book has made a big difference to me as well.
That's a great list. I will link to these books in the show notes if anybody is interested in those 3 books. I usually like to pick up the books that my guests suggest, so I'll probably be, especially Reinventing Organizations, definitely going to be diving into that one as soon as I finish the stack of like 17 books that are unread on my desk. But that's a great list. Thank you. What is your favorite rock climb of all times?
Favorite rock climb?
Favorite rock climb all time. Bouldering, sport climbing, you get to pick.
Well, it's not going to be bouldering.
I just want to give you the option.
Let's see. Favorite rock climb of all time. So one thing that comes to mind is Misty at Sand Rock.
That's a great one. That's a classic.
It is a reason. Classic. I mean, it's not the world's best rock climb, but it's been an important part of my climbing journey.
Sure.
And then another is maybe Squeeze the Trigger, which is at Foster Falls.
Super fun.
The hardest rated rock climb I've done, and was really satisfying that when that one went. So that's another favorite for sure.
That's good. I mean, those are two good ones for sure. And for anybody who's listening who doesn't know what in the heck we're talking about, I'll try to find like a video or something about these rock climbs to show you. Again, thank you so much for your answers, for your time, for your insights. This is incredibly valuable. I've really, really enjoyed and loved this conversation. Where can people find you? Like on the internets, online, learn more about you, about your company, about your dashing good looks. You know, where can people learn more about Alistair Stewart?
LinkedIn is definitely a good place to find me. I don't think there are too many people with my first and last name on there, so it shouldn't be too hard to narrow down. Twitter, I use it sometimes. But either of those places, you could definitely DM me or reach out to me, and I'd love to chat. And then you can just go to theready.com to learn more about The Ready and the work that we do. And on that note, if I could just add one more book to my recommended books list.
Oh, you may, of course.
I know that it's more than three. But our founder, Aaron Dignan, wrote a book called Brave New Work that really digs into a lot of the stuff we've talked about today. So I, if you want sort of a one book to read that gives a really amazing overview of the history and the principles and the theory, but also a lot of different practices that you can use in your organization. It's an incredible resource for that. So I would also recommend that people check out Brave New Work.
Well, no, that's great. Just one more time, Alistair, thank you so much for your time and being on the show. I really enjoyed it. And hopefully we can, maybe do another episode again soon.
Yeah, I would love that. Thank you for having me. I think this is a really important conversation. And obviously the work that, healthcare workers across the board are doing is extremely important now more than ever. And they work under extremely challenging conditions. And so I'm super grateful to all of them. And if any of this stuff helps make any of their working lives easier or makes it easier for them to pursue their purpose, then that would be amazing. So yeah, thank you to them and thank you to you.